Welcome to the Pace Your Performance podcast. Today, I'm speaking to Head of Performance Science and Medicine at the Lawn Tennis Association, Dan Lewinden. Thanks for tuning in to episode 313 of the Pace Your Performance podcast. So I know I say this absolutely every single week, but Dan has been on the hit list for years, absolutely years, since the release of High Performance Training for Sports, which he co-edited with David Joyce. And it was that book that really opened my eyes to the great practitioners, researchers and sports scientists that were actually out there in the world, and it actually made you feel like you got to know these guys. And I'm lucky enough to have had a number of the authors in that book on the podcast, and actually use that book, as I mentioned this episode, as a way of getting people on and knowing who to get on and who might be good and offer insights for the podcast. So in this episode with Dan, slightly different, we go down a bit of a leadership and management angle and get a bit of an insight into Dan's transition from a clinician and a physiotherapist into the role that he's got now at the Lawn Tennis Association, which is Head of Performance Science and Medicine. So we go into detail around characters, the guys that he's employed at the LTA, what he looks for, what he doesn't look for, getting rid of and removing silos, stopping silos from forming, all the kind of stuff that a leader and a manager would be interested in. So if you are interested in making that transition, whether it be now or in the future, or just understanding more about that transition, about that role, this episode will be an absolute must listen for you. So I hope you enjoy this chat with Dan, and I'd love your feedback, and I will speak to you soon. This episode of the Pace Your Performance podcast is sponsored by Perch. Perch enables velocity-based training, no strings attached. Engineered at MIT, Perch uses small and mobile cameras to monitor and manage weight room performance without detracting from it. By passively collecting speed and power data, delivering it in real time to athletes, and storing it for post-workout analysis, Perch enhances workouts, reduces injuries, and saves time. Perch works with every level of organization, from the 2019 National Championship LSU football team, to the NFL's New York Giants, military installations, high schools, and to a number of growing sports performance facilities, and even individual garage gyms. Perch is portable, easy to install, and intuitive to use, making it ideal for every facility and every training goal. No more pre-workout setup, no more attachments to athletes and barbells, no more broken strings. Set Perch up once and optimize every rep. Reach out to Perch today, and for exclusive deals and offers, tell them Rob sent you by going to perch.fit/pacey. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is sponsored by Kitman Labs. So Kitman Labs partners with leading sports teams to help them consistently achieve the highest levels of performance by increasing the impact of their data. So over 200 teams across the globe rely on Kitman Labs' performance intelligence platform to quantify the cost of performance and injury and receive the right insights at the right time. Through unique outcome-driven analytics and the most advanced athlete management system, teams can align their organizations around a shared view of what it takes to drive performance and health and move at the speed of sport to adjust and continuously improve. If you want to know more about Kitman Labs, head over to www.win.kitmanlabs.com/impact. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is sponsored by iMeasureU. So used by leading sports practitioners and biomechanics researchers worldwide to capture and compare multi-limb inertial data in the field, IMU Step from iMeasureU is a dual sensor and app lower limb load monitoring tool which helps practitioners optimize return to play for running-based sports. So iMeasureU have just released their new and improved waterproof sensor Blue Trident, which includes ultra-high G capabilities to quantify high-impact steps such as cutting, landing and sprinting, longer battery life to collect data all day, real-time feedback to aid immediate interventions, and faster workflow so practitioners can review long training sessions within minutes of training completion. iMeasureU, now part of Vicon, works with military, pro and collegiate coaches and athletes from around the world, including the Australian Institute of Sport, US Department of Defence and collegiate and pro teams from around the world. If you want to get to know more about iMeasureU, head over to their website imeasureu.com or follow them on Twitter or Instagram at iMeasureU. So without further ado, over to the episode with Dan Lewenden. Thanks for tuning in to the Pace Performance Podcast. So this evening, I'm delighted to welcome Dan Lewenden. So welcome to the podcast, mate.
Hello, mate. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Really appreciate you staying at the office for a little bit longer to have a little chat. Really do appreciate it. Anyone that doesn't know who you are, you just want to give us a bit of background on yourself, education-wise, experience, what you're currently doing at the LTA.
Sure, no worries. So I guess I am a 42-year-old husband and father of two girls, and I live in Leicestershire, a little village. I'm the head of performance science and medicine at the LTA, which is the national governing body of tennis in the UK. And I've been in role here now for about 4 years. And I guess to give you my journey to this chair and this conversation, I guess like many of us, I was a mad keen sportsman in my youth. Liked playing rugby, wasn't particularly good, but enjoyed it. Spent a fair bit of time on a physio bed with the usual aches and pains, and inevitably got the light bulb moment in my mid-teens that there was something here for me in terms of a future career working perhaps in sport. And I remember at the time, my careers advisor told me to be an architect or an accountant, so that sealed the deal. So I went to University of Nottingham and did an undergraduate degree in physiotherapy. And then was fortunate to begin my career in a hospital in Leicester, Leicester General Hospital, where, again, I was pretty lucky that I was in quite a strong peer group of people who were either involved in sport or definitely had some key specialism and understanding in sport. And working there for a couple of years, I managed to get a weekend role working for Loughborough University for their rugby team, which kind of put me on the front line of Saturday rugby, which was pretty frightening as a learning curve. Did that for a couple of years, had some brilliant times there, learned an enormous amount, I guess, about sports injuries and management, acute management. And a couple of players from there got scouted by Northampton Saints. And then, I guess, a few years later, when a job came up, I managed to get myself a role at Northampton Rugby Club. And I was there for about 6 years, give or take, kind of, working my way through the ranks. And I guess during that time, I got pretty fascinated in that mid to late stage rehab piece that we all talk about quite a lot. And I could see at that point, this is some time ago now, that kind of understanding more about strength conditioning, exercise science, and I guess sports science more broadly would be ever so helpful. So I put myself through a couple of MSCs in sports medicine in London and exercise science in Perth, Edith Cowan. And that kind of got me on the road to hopefully being a little bit more technically proficient. And then in 2009, I was approached about the England role. So working as part of the senior team with England Rugby and the kind of working as part of an absolutely brilliant performance support team, under a number of really good coaches. Who had huge experience and understanding, and were just generally great people. And I was there for about 7 years. And I guess during that time, shameless plugs are coming. David Joyce, a good mate of mine, and I had this harebrained idea to write a couple of books after a couple of drinks, which we duly did, which was a massive learning experience, and gave us this massive network of people globally, with real specialism in their areas. And I guess at the time, the motivation for that was one, CPD for us, free CPD. I guess two was recognizing that performance support was more than just physio and S&C. It was that synergy and cohesion of a number of ologies working together. So we did that, which was fantastic and an absolute labor of love. Shameless plug, second edition coming before the end of the year.
Boom, get it in.
And then in fast forward to 2016, I was approached by a guy called Peter Keane, who was the interim performance director at the LTA. And he kind of talked to me about this new role and said it might be something of interest. And kind of when I looked at it, it was exactly what I wanted to do next in terms of moving away from technical delivery into kind of leadership and management and strategy, and the opportunity to kind of create something and deliver something in a sport for the long term. So I guess in summary, mate, that's my 20 odd years in performance sport. Feels like it's been a steep learning curve from the start. It feels like the last 4 years have been unbelievably steep, you know, moving from a sport that I was really familiar and comfortable in to one which I had really no frame of reference on whatsoever. And again, moving into a very different space in terms of role. And I'm here today. There you go. Still in one piece.
Superb. I'm interested to know what came off the back of the book. Because like I said to you before we started recording, that was probably the first book that really got me interested in, firstly, in reading, to be honest. Not really done it because I had to, but that was the first book that I actually wanted to read and exposed me to the likes of, like I mentioned to you before, Mike McGuigan, yourself, David Joyce. And that was actually my go-to, like genuinely my go-to list for podcast guests in the first probably year. Like, who's been in high performance training for sports? They're my guys. So did anything else come off the back of that? I'm just interested in, like, from a business point of view, from an exposure point of view, did anything come off the back of that? Or was it just the kind of book and then move on?
So I think definitely we've got a network that I've leaned on ever since. So in terms of the people that we've worked with, so that for me, that's been the biggest and most pervasive element of it. I mean, financially, it's certainly not worth doing. So just want to call that out now. I met Franz Bosch. This is a bit of off track, but I met Franz Bosch, you know, in a hotel in London, like a year after it was out, maybe 2 years after it was out, and we were talking about it. And he said, I've done my own book now and I'm self-publishing, so I'm going to take 90% of the royalties. And that was quite hard to take at the time. Actually, more power to him. But I think, for me, the biggest thing always was CPD, understanding these people and what really makes them tick. So making it a colloquial text that isn't vested in science, but it's all about what do they really think and what do they really do. That was really important to us. And I guess off the back of that, the conversations you have as you kind of narrate the chapter, you really get to understand their points of view, which was unbelievably helpful for me at the time as I'm trying to navigate that space of kind of not just physio, but other ologies as well. I think in terms of what it's given me beyond that, I mean, at the time I was working at the RFU, and to be, you know, they were fairly strict on me in terms of how I could leverage that and indeed couldn't leverage that. So it wasn't something that I was able to promote myself through social media or other channels. I just had to kind of do it. And obviously Dave was able to do that within the context of his role. So I guess in terms of kind of, I guess, brand development, if you want to call it that, it didn't necessarily create that for me, but that was never the intent. So I think for me it was, meeting really good people who were at the top of the game who could articulate it in a really simple way, and that's brilliant.
I'd agree. One thing that might take us into the first topic of conversation, which is the kind of building of performance structures in terms of people. One thing that I'm interested in is that transition. I spoke to Des Ryan about this a couple of months ago, that transition from hands-on coaching or therapy or in a clinical setting to then be the leadership, so the leader or the manager, leadership management. And I'm interested in that transition for you. Was that tough? Like, it's always people's natural thing, like getting good at your job, getting a little bit of success. Okay, I want to be a manager and maybe remove themselves from what they've been really good at to this role that maybe they've not done before, maybe not spoken or not thought too much about. But it's just it's the next progression is that leadership management role. How's that been for you? And how did you navigate that? You're still in the role, so you're always doing it successfully. So how did you navigate that and what have you learned since?
Brilliant question. And I think it's been an incredibly steep learning curve and I'm still learning as I'm sitting here today, 4 years in. I think I took some time over whether I would take the role because I was in a really good space with England, you know, on the crest of a wave with Eddie Jones and things were going brilliantly. And I did take some diligence over a kind of month to look at what it would mean for me personally. How would I need to change what I do and how I behave and what I bring in that new space? I was somewhat fortunate, I guess, that I came into the role where there wasn't a clearly defined strategy. There wasn't a settled and well-structured team. It was at the very beginning of the journey. So you had the opportunity possibly to fail fast and learn fast and kind of find your feet. But I guess as a character, I'm a planner and a thinker. So I probably spent the month leading up to it rehearsing my first 100 days, starting to learn about the sport before I came into it, reading the first of about 500,000 leadership and management books, you know, to start to get myself geared up for what I might expect. The hardest thing, as I'm sure Des said, and I'm sure lots of people would say, is frequently there's a moment where you could just take control of the doing because it's somewhere you're really familiar being, something you've done a million times before. And you have to really fight the urge to do that. That said, being someone who's technically experienced, there are opportunities and times where you can kind of, I guess, problem solve and manage with the people that you have within your team. But you've got to walk the tightrope of empowering them, supporting them, developing them versus undermining them by kind of stepping in as some kind of all-conquering hero. And it's pretty tough, to be honest with you. And it still is as tough today as it was on the first day. And it's, I guess, I didn't fully appreciate how different it is to sit in this space, you know, because when you're under pressure and you're under duress and things are tough, you naturally kind of gravitate back towards where you've been before and you want to get closer to the action and you want to start doing some doing because you're going to feel confident when you're there. So I don't know whether I'm answering that or not, mate, but I think that the reality is it's tough. You've got to be well prepared for it. And you've got to anticipate it continuing to raise its head, I think, under duress.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you can read as many books as you want, but until you're in the firing line, it's a completely different story. But was there any books that, looking back, did prepare you even that little bit for what was gonna come? Anything that stands out?
I think before I started, they do. I mean, the only book you need to buy is High Performance Training.
It's High Performance Training Sports. Yeah,
but that notwithstanding, I guess there was a book called The First 100 Days, which is about the first 100 days coming into a kind of leadership role, which was a brilliant book, and I read that kind of ahead of time. And Ray Dalio's Principles book, I read and have reread because that gives me a lot. Having come into the role, as we'll talk about a little bit more later, books like Made to Stick by the Heath Brothers, which is a very short book all about language, communication, and making things stick. I've been reading a book in Soft Skills by Peggy Klaus. So there's a plethora of them, mate, and you know, I could give you a roller deck and maybe share them at the end, but they're the ones at the minute that kind of really stick out for me.
Mm-hmm. I've written them down, so we're all good. But Principles, just on that, I got a sponsored tweet, I think it was, our sponsored Instagram post from Ray Dalio, has actually got an app called Principles, where there's all the videos, I don't think it's the chapters, because obviously you got to read the book, but all the basically the learning resources around Principles.
Yep.
So, yeah. I'm actually reading it now, or listening to it now on Audible. Yeah.
Mate, brilliant. Yeah. I mean, he did a short video, didn't he, on YouTube, which I've seen.
Yes. Yes.
Really pissed me off that because I watched that 2 minutes and that's the book.
Yes.
And it's a big book, you know.
Yeah. Deep. It's long, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's worth a read.
Yeah. Yeah. But one thing that I wanted to get you on, the thing that I wanted to get you on here to discuss was off the back of the UKCA's Interdisciplinary Teams Roundtable, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And just to get your thoughts on structuring a team and pulling a team together, building a team, what that structure looks like. What does that look like from an LTA point of view to start with? Maybe what did that look like when you came? What does it look like now? They may be the same, but how you would, or what you would like to see maybe moving forward as well?
So I guess if I were to summarize to start and then go into examples of kind of my journey, is ultimately it's a similar process to working with an athlete one-on-one, because it starts with understanding their world. It then requires you to kind of build something really clear in terms of a vision for and a plan for how you're going to make them better. You then have to align your resources behind it to make sure you can deliver that. And then you've got to review your progress. And I think that in a nutshell is what it is when you're starting to talk about building and creating teams, from my perspective anyway. I guess for me, you know, coming into this role, as I say, I wasn't replacing someone. It was a role, I guess, which hadn't been a reality for a number of years, without a clear strategic direction. And so the first thing I needed to do was, as I said earlier, take some time to understand what I was walking into. You know, what's the landscape of the sport here? What are the people like? What's the culture? What are the challenges? Where are the clear opportunities to make progress? What are the current levels of performance in terms of holistically to player development rather than your staff at that point? And what's been done before? So inevitably, good people have tried stuff. It's either worked or it's failed, and it's good to know why. And for me, that was the first bit. So understand what you're stepping into. And as I said earlier as well, you know, I came from a sport which was highly settled, very organized, highly progressive in terms of sports science integration within a kind of coaching structure and a team sport, you know, and it was a complete 180 in terms of the environment I was walking into. And there were huge positives. I mean, some of the people, as I might say later on, that work in tennis, absolutely brilliant. But culturally, as an individual sport, which is highly nomadic, highly financially pressurized, and quite chaotic, you know, it's very hard to have a system. It's a very different model. So I think for the first thing is, yeah, understanding the world. So understanding the people, seeing things through their eyes, really taking the time to be kind of open to what they've seen and experienced and what they need. I think behind that, you then need to build a kind of clear direction of travel. And again, within my role, I was really fortunate to kind of join a senior management team of kind of coaches and a performance director where we were creating this, you know, from the first moment I walked in. And we had a brilliant ride of 3 months doing that. But I guess what you get out of that then is you've got an absolutely clear strategic direction, something that everyone can articulate, something really simple, very explicit, aspirational, a bit scary, but everything's going to pair back to it. So whatever that kind of statement of intent is that you're going after, you then need the detail behind it of, okay, well, that's brilliant, but how do you actually achieve that? And what are the milestones, the KPIs, the tactics, the kind of what's the workflow that's going to sit behind doing that? And I think once you've got that, so you've got a direction on where you're going, you've got an understanding, I guess, strategically about what's the detail behind it. It is then a case of looking at structurally, what does performance support look like? So not who have we got, but how is it organized? Who do people report into to have maximum impact and influence? Is there a clear hierarchy? Are the right bums on the right seats? Have we got enough people? To break it up with a story, I went to Dave Joyce's wedding, and he typical Joyce, he sat me tactically next to this husband and wife. And the husband was a Fortune 500 CEO, brilliant bloke. And his wife was head of PR for some massive American company. And I sat there and they said, what's your story? So I said, oh, I've just taken this new job, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm in a period now looking at change management. And literally, I'll never forget this. The bloke put his knife and fork down and said, look, within 30 seconds of meeting anyone, you know whether you want them in your team. You'll just have the feel. And after that, you're just asking questions of yourself unnecessarily. And he started eating again. And his wife kind of spat a drink out and said, no, you can't do that. You know, you've got to take time and really understand what they can give. And your initial impression is more about whether you like them or not, rather than whether they can do what you need them to do.
Okay.
So I was more confused than ever. And I guess to summarize my own interpretation of that and how I've worked in the role that I have, It was clear when I kind of assumed my role that there were some people who had been working in the system for a long time through some really difficult times, you know, at the LTA, and either weren't in the right space, or it wasn't, you know, by their own admission, perhaps it was time for them to start thinking about something different. And clearly you can gravitate towards stuff like S&C and physio and possibly have a clearer sense of what's right and what's wrong. But actually, as I said before, because the culture and the landscape and the requirements are so different, I did take my time to look at, okay, you know, really carefully, have we got the right kind of technical qualities, diversity of thought, you know, levels of enthusiasm and engagement to really get the various areas done? And it took, you know, the process took a number of years, you know, and it was a steady process. I was going to say, I mean, again, you've then got a position where hopefully you've got a clear structure to deliver against your promise. You've got the right kind of blend of technical expertise, tennis experience, disruptors, diversity of thought. You got some young, hungry go-getters. You got some wise old owls. You know, you got some people that can, who understand the status quo in the landscape and who can at the right time challenge the status quo in the landscape. And you've got that nice blend, haven't you, of guest tennis IQ and broader sports science, medicine IQ from other environments. And if you know, hopefully if you get it right, you've got a melting pot of brilliant ideas, you know, and hopefully a cohesive team that's going to go get some stuff.
Would you have taken that approach in a different environment? So maybe previous environments, would you have gone with the guy, the husband rather than the wife? Or would you gravitate, given your personality, to take your time, being a bit more methodical about it?
No, I think my character trait is quick to draw.
Okay.
<Come on. laughs> I think if I'd gone into a similar role within a very familiar sport, let's just say it was rugby, I probably would have made decisions really, really quickly. And I think that would have fallen foul of historical interpretation of what good looks like and probably gravitating quickly towards people that saw things through the same eyes that I do. I mean, I was 4 years younger than I am today. And I've got a less clear understanding today for the right reasons of what we need to do. So I think if I was now starting this role again today in a team sport, familiar environment, I'd take my time. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I've got written down here was diversity of thought, which I think is a, I think you might have mentioned it in the round table actually, or someone brought that up.
Yeah.
How important is that for you? And again, come back to the chat that I had with Des around the character of the S&C coach that he's employing, what that looks like over and above the technical aspect. We get the technical aspects, that's fine, but what kind of character we're looking for? And the diversity of thought is an interesting one for me, of how you go about identifying the right people who do think a little bit differently and aren't just telling you what you want to hear, or like you said, going on previous, this is what we did before, so this is what we'll keep doing, all that kind of stuff. How do you go about navigating that and getting the right people who do have different thought processes and think differently to you and the rest of the team, of course?
Yeah, so I guess it's a tricky process, this, because you've got to get the blend right of people that can hit the ground running, who really understand the sporting domain that they're coming into and have done it before, you know, versus those who have come from a completely different but equally, you know, appreciable background in a different sport and a different environment and can see things through different lenses. And I guess diversity of thought is a bit of a buzzword at the minute. And there's obviously a brilliant book by Matthew Syed around this kind of topic. I do think it's very important. And I guess the reason I think it's very important is from a personal perspective to challenge my receive wisdoms of what I think good looks like is really important. And as a result, for those within my team, just the same description. I think the other thing as well at the minute is that the world we live in now is more complex than it's ever been. It's faster paced than it's ever been. And it's only going to get quicker. And I think if you look at the landscape of sport and the impact of the environment broadly, COVID recently, the demands that are going to be placed on our athletes and the environments they're going to work within and the expectations put upon them and the opportunities available to them are going to constantly change. And I think, again, the diversity piece here is bringing people in who have seen excellence in different sports, but also have not polarized views, but clarity of view, you know. And I think then it's that piece around, you know, you want technical skills are a given, and I'm sure everyone says this, you know, everyone now within their ologies, they're all going to have high quality technical skills. So for me, it does come down to, in no particular order, their levels of energy, the levels of curiosity, you know, how much do they want to understand about this new world that they're coming into. Self-awareness, something that I'm personally kind of challenging myself to be better at. So how aware are they of their limitations? How aware are they of how they perform under pressure? How aware are they of the knowledge gaps that they've got within their ology, within the sport and more broadly? And what are their plans to fill it? You know, what's their level of proactive drive and self-determination to kind of go after the stuff that they know they need to get better at? And how comfortable are they to articulate that to a recruiter, me, or a kind of a line manager? Gives you a real sense of kind of what they're about. And then, you know, a massive thing for me in this space is about relationships. You know, nomadic sport, limited time with the coach, with the player. You've got to be good at building relationships to then be able to have hopefully the right influence at the right moment to create the kind of maybe the change you need to see, or to support the coach and the player in the right way. And then I think for me, stuff like having generalist skills, so understanding your own ology, understanding the other ones so you can work in a kind of cohesive manner, perhaps having a USP, an area of personal interest which you're really passionate about. Almost doesn't matter what it is and how connected it is to what we're doing. It's just the fact you got something that you know you that lights your fire. And then I guess for me as well, there's a piece around agility and adaptability. You know, complex system, rapidly moving, lots of parts. How adaptable can this person be when they need to be? So that's the kind of the mush, I guess, of which diversity of thought forms a big part of.
So we're just going to take a very quick break in the chat with Dan. Hope you're enjoying part one. So part two gets a little bit more tennis specific in to do with Dan's role, but also his views on performance, how the tennis structure in the UK is affecting the development and the growth of the game, but also the high performance end of the game as well. So a really interesting part two coming up with Dan. But just before we do dive into part two, I want to say a big thanks to Hawking Dynamics for sponsoring this episode today. So Hawking Dynamics offer the world's first wireless force play testing system. So the Hawking Dynamics system is built around what coaches want, so they can test in the real world and not just in the lab. So you're able to capture reliable data on all athletes in a matter of minutes and monitor progress from their cloud-based system from anywhere in the world. So as I've mentioned, the Hawking Dynamics force plates are wireless, which means they're portable, and they're also trusted by teams at a number of different levels in a number of different sports. So integrating force plates into your athlete monitoring system could not be easier and more affordable. So if you want to get to know a little bit more about Hawking Dynamics or actually see their plates in action, head over to the website, which is hawkingdynamics.com, which you can do, and you can also schedule a demo and follow them on Twitter at Hawking Dynamics. And also sponsoring this episode today is Black Box Fitness. So Black Box Fitness are a sports performance equipment manufacturer based in Belfast in Northern Ireland. So if you are looking for a full gym fit out, if you're lucky enough to be looking for a full gym fit out, or just want to add additional pieces to what you've already got, whether that be barbells, dumbbells, plates, maybe a new rack, some flooring, etc., etc., have a little look at what Black Box Fitness can offer. So you can head to their website, which is blkboxfitness.com, or for a more informal view of what they do, head over to their Instagram, because they've got some really cool images of some of the recent projects that they've run in Australia, in the UK, in Europe, etc. So head over to their Instagram, which is at blkboxfitness, and they're the same on Twitter. It's funny because Eddie Jones mentioned curiosity. I think that was his number, maybe so, number one when I asked a similar question. Yeah, yeah. Self-awareness. I'd like to dig a little bit deeper into that if we can, and just your journey in that area. Because I think it's something that I think a lot about for myself and look at others and probably judge others on that front. What's your Yeah, what's your journey in the developing self-awareness or being aware of yourself, own self-awareness?
So my wife's been banging on about it for a decade, but I guess for me, if I rewind the clock to kind of...
What's your wife do?
She's actually a physio. She's far better physio than I ever was.
Okay.
But she was actually, she worked in that Leicester General Hospital where I started my kind of career. So she took advantage of me as a senior physio.
Okay.
That's out there now as well. I think my journey into self-awareness for the first 10 years of my career, so kind of, let's say 2000, 2012, 13, I was on this drive towards getting better. So everything was about knowing more, being technically better, having the answers, understanding S&C, physio, nutrition, you know, really kind of going after that. And midway through that journey, I went to one of those evening lectures where you get a number of kind of experts talking about their domains. And there was one guy particularly that I wanted to hear from. He had a really impressive job working as part of a really high performing sports team. And he spent 40 minutes talking about how it wasn't about what you know, but it's about how you communicate and how aware you are of your own self within that kind of team dynamic. And I was really pissed off at the time, thinking, I've come here to learn about what to do, and you're telling me about this stuff. This is irrelevant. And it always sticks in my mind. And then I think I got to 2012, 13, 14. You know, I've been within the England setup for a while, around some really brilliant people, many of whom very experienced, highly proficient. But it became very apparent that the strength of the group wasn't about what they knew, but it was their collective sense of teammanship, and how they worked together, and how we had an implicit understanding of how to communicate and work together really well under pretty high levels of stress and then sometimes under lower levels of stress. And I guess that got me thinking about it more. And I guess there's no doubt coming into this role, there's a sharp kind of learning curve on that space, because it's all about what you understand of yourself, what makes you tick, how do you perform well under pressure, what happens when you perform poorly, what happens to your communication, you know, how do you build relationships? And I guess the further up you go, or the more experienced I've become, it's become about leveraging influence through relationships. You know, you can know as much as you want, but if you articulate it in a kind of overly flamboyant scientific manner, at best, no one understands. And at worst, they think you're a bit of a dick. You know, so it's that journey of understanding, you know, who you are, what makes you tick, how you get the most enjoyment out of the roles that you occupy, how you get the most out of the people around you, but also, I guess, as a leader, those within your team as well. That's where it stemmed from me. And I guess as a subset of that, as I said, you know, communication skills, understanding that it's not what you open your mouth and say, but it's how well you can listen and whether you can really put yourself in the shoes of the person that you're talking to and really understand the world through their eyes. It's critical stuff. And I think it underpins everything we do as practitioners and people generally. And for some people, I guess, listening to this, this is obvious stuff. For me, it was quite transformational, you know, and it was something that came to me, as I say, at least 10 years into my journey in this space. And it's something that I'm better at than I used to be. But I still, as I said earlier, you know, I'm a bit trigger happy. So, I've still got areas that I'm working on to become a better person, better leader, better manager, better team member.
Do you think people, given the emphasis on communication, probably in the last 3 or 4 years with like Brett, who you've mentioned about bringing the book, little plug again for the book, nailed it. Do you think people are focusing on that? What you focused on, okay, I need to know everything. I need to know about what's left and right. And then having the epiphany that maybe more about communication further down the line after you put all that work in. Do you think because of that increased emphasis on communication, people are jumping a little bit too far ahead with that aspect and maybe not focus as much on the first knowing as much as you possibly can? Or do you think that's better to start early to then develop simultaneously?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can't have one without the other, can you? So you can't have, if there's no substance behind how you communicate, you're not going to have the outcomes you want to have. I guess for me, I wish I'd started a bit earlier, more from the perspective of managing my own emotions. You know, working, I guess, within the England rugby setup, you know, through some pretty big highs and some pretty big lows, under relatively high amounts of pressure from my perspective. Being aware of it sooner and how it was having an impact on me would have helped me be better in my role. But I think equally, you know, we're all chasing to be as good as we can be at the delivery piece. I just think they go hand in hand. I wish I'd started a bit earlier for sure.
Mm-hmm. One thing that came up in the UKSCA roundtable was dealing with silos. How do you, given what I've just said, how do you try to stop silos from forming or deal with them should you walk into a role where they are present, obviously present?
Yeah, so I guess it's tricky. There's different types of silos, aren't there? There's an intentional silo, which on the part of a practitioner, a coach, a player, or an external influence, someone is trying to form a silo from a personal perspective, which I guess we've all probably experienced. The more unintentional stuff tends to be around poor process, lack of understanding around role responsibility, lack of understanding of what kind of cohesive integrated working can look like. Impact of pressure, as I said before, you know, under pressure back in the day, you retreat to where you're comfortable, don't you? And that inevitably forms a kind of, I'm going to control this, and I'm going to own this, and this is going to be for me kind of thing. So I think it depends on the cause to an extent. I guess talking from personal experience, there's no doubt that through no fault of their own, the team that I kind of came into work with had created silos. Possibly partly out of lack of leadership because there just wasn't someone in that space for a period of time, partly because of a lack of strategic direction and it being a really explicit thing and real clarity about what we're going after as a group here. Partly for us, it was about the environment we were in. So I'm sitting in the National Tennis Centre today, which is, you know, over the last 12 months had a massive renovation of this space. But before then, the S&C coaches would have their office, which would be at least three rooms away from the physios who had individual physio rooms. The gym wasn't connected to anything that was further out of the way. The coaches sat on the other end of the building. The analysts sat downstairs. So your environment is never going to create an interdisciplinary or cohesive model, is it? So a big thing for us was to constrain the environment and build an open plan space, which, you know, we're all really proud of now, where we genuinely can sit together. And then naturally, if you've got curious people, you're going to start to ask questions of each other and start to get, you know, involved in stuff. So that was a really big thing for us, which really helped us. I think for me, as I say, in my experience, the vast majority of them are completely unintentional and come as an outcome of stress, pressure, and circumstance. So I guess my management for that, in terms of how I would look to improve that situation, is definitely vested in recognizing it, bringing the people together who are operating that way, and just having that in the room is something that's recognized as through no fault. This is about the problem, not the people. And to start to look at ways that we can either create cross-functional projects around players, if it's a player-based silo situation, or coach and practitioners around kind of problem solving. It's just trying to create opportunities in environments for them to work together cross-functionally. A big thing I always do with my team is the rule of three rooms. So if you, with any situation, if you put the player in one room, the coach in another, the practitioners in a third, and you ask them the same question about what are you chasing, what's important, and what are we doing, would they give the same answers? Because if they're not, and it's never going to be perfect, but if they're not universally connected about what they're chasing, that's a silo. You know, they aren't working together. They're working in parallel, or they're working in a disconnected way. So that's something that we kind of talk about regularly as a group. So I think, yeah, there's a number of things behind it. And working within the England setup, there was a number of examples where there were intentional silos being created, either through external practitioners who had a real vested interest in an athlete and kind of wanted to become involved in that space. And again, back in the day, with a relative lack of self-awareness, I'm happy to say that what I would do is kind of blow my lid about that. But the way that we kind of worked around that was to recognize the power of our collective. So if myself and our doctor and our other physio and our S&C coach and our coach were really connected around that player and how we wanted to help them, naturally they would see the quality of that. And equally, overtly bringing that external practitioner into the space, so we're all working together around and just acknowledging that the only important thing is the player at the center of it, was the way that ultimately we could break down some of those silos in that example.
Mm-hmm. What, from a day-to-day point of view, having you all in the same room in that open office, apart from the obvious, you can actually talk between yourselves, what difference has that made to projects that have been going on, to just what you're actually there to do, which is support the athletes and the coaches?
I'm going to caveat that and say that the month that it was finished, it was lockdown.
So we don't know yet.
we had about a month before, and we've certainly had a couple of months now. And I guess what it does is it makes everything visible. You know, so we have some brilliant analysts working for our kind of team, who, as I say, previously were sitting in some kind of rat cave beneath everybody, scrolling away. And now their desktops are on kind of live view. So and they've got a view out onto the kind of courts beneath them. And as our coaches walk in, they can see what the analysts are working on in terms of what match is it, what's happening. And these potentially are analysts who are working with an individual coach or a player or a project, but it creates an immediate visual opportunity to ask a question of, you know, what's that? And similarly, as a kind of a constraining environment element, an analyst or a nutritionist or a physio walking into that space, seeing a coach they have not seen for a while, immediately enables you to strike that personal relationship, you know, and have that chat, which inevitably then leads on to, how can we make this better? You know, so I think it creates a bit of a forcing function where you know, hopefully you're all wanting to be in this space and starting to have richer conversations around player problems. We've got a really good, you know, office at the end, just a simple office, big TV at the end. And it's literally a case of, you know, why don't we throw a player up here and have a conversation about, you know, what we're doing and how we can do it better. It's just examples like that, I think, which are going to help us a lot. And it's not all about the environment, but it certainly helped us. And as I say, in such a nomadic sport where some of our coaches could be out on the road for 20 weeks, practitioners could be away for a number of months, you know, those convergence points are even more special. You know, you've got to make the most of them.
Just bring it back to tennis specifically and the support across the country, because I know this has probably changed since I've known. What's that look like nationally from a tennis perspective, the support of the athletes out there?
So I guess it's a long pathway process, which starts in earnest kind of around under 10, under 11 currently. And it's the traditional kind of model of county, regional, national progression of a young person. And it operates, as I say, from around under 10 all the way into that elite space. And I guess the role of the LTA is to connect that pathway up. There are some areas where we do some direct delivery. There's some areas where we just, if you like, support that system in terms of financial investment and performance advice. But the idea is that they're overridingly, strategically, there was a connected pathway from the first time you pick up a racket in earnest until the kind of hopefully you're a self-sustained top 100, you know, highly successful kind of player at the end of it. And it's going back into this, it is a punitive sport in the UK. It costs a lot of money to play tennis. And one of our big things as an organization is understanding how we can significantly impact that and make it much easier to access, much cheaper. Perhaps in the eyes of some, you know, more relevant and, you know, move with the times in that space. And I guess we've spent a lot of time looking at the 14 to 18 year old space, where there was a big gap when I first started, that you were really good at under 10, 11, 12. Then there was nothing really for you until you were either somehow very good at 16, 17, or you weren't. And the LTA invested heavily in two national academies with kind of full-time education from a holistic support perspective, but also intensive training with high-quality coaching and kind of performance support, with the idea that that's the area where we can really incentivize development of players and hopefully have bigger numbers coming out the top.
So the further they go up the rankings, they're self-employed, almost like self-employed athletes as they get to the top end. Does that support, i.e. the performance support, still keep coming from you, or are they kind of choosing their own medics? And is that a bit of a mix?
It's a mix. I mean, I think the intention always is to create a system where the player is developed and empowered to an extent that they can choose their own team really well, chase stuff really hard, be self-sustaining, absolutely. I mean, I think that inevitably, from a relationship perspective, but also from a support perspective, we have a Davis Cup and Fed Cup team of elite players. And, you know, we obviously have a head of men's and head of women's tennis that kind of oversee those spaces. And as a result, you need to retain strong relationships and connections, hopefully, with those players at the top end. And what we offer through the National Tennis Centre is a kind of, I guess, bespoke support at base. What we don't resource is people on the road to support those players, because, yeah, they are hopefully by then, you know, making their millions, give or take.
Yeah. So from a performance standpoint, how did you and how do your team start to understand what's important from a physical preparation point of view of tennis players? Coming from your background in rugby, and you mentioned during this chat about getting people from other sports and have a diversity of thought, all that kind of stuff. How do we dial that down into understanding what's important for tennis?
That's a massive question. So I guess in no particular order, sitting within the rugby space now, you know, I could tell you the meters per minute that our scrum half would need to operate at an international level to be successful. You know, the numbers of collisions they were going to have, it was very well understood. And as a result, I guess the tactical preparation of players within that system was incredibly strong, and the underpinning physical requirements were really good. Coming into the tennis space, where at the time when I started, there wasn't any player monitoring in terms of, I guess, for want of a better description, heart rate, GPS, accelerometry, there wasn't really that level of granular understanding. And there was a very fragmented understanding, I guess, about some of the physical on-court requirements to be successful. And inevitably within tennis, you've got players of all shapes and sizes, different game styles, which are affected by opponents and by surfaces. So it's quite, again, quite a complex system there to kind of get your head around. And I guess our process and one of my learnings has been, I try to come in quite quickly and espouse the kind of load management, load awareness, you know, understanding the physical determinants of the sport, really important. But I was two steps ahead of perhaps where I needed to be, and I needed to get structure, people, just the basics going. I guess in the last 2 years, having bedded some of that stuff in, and I guess with an increased curiosity on the part of our players and coaches, and a kind of, I guess, a new world understanding of the kind of value that this kind of stuff can bring, we're now in a much more fortunate position where players are more comfortable to wear equipment to start to understand physical determinants. And there's still challenges. So unlike a team that moves with a sports scientist and a team that can kind of dock and undock and upload and reconfigure and present, you know, we're often talking about coach plus player in their own environment without support around them. We need solutions which are simple, robust, Bluetooth, which do provide, you know, structured feedback to them quickly in language that they understand and really engage with. So we had to go through quite a long process of understanding what those kind of tools were. And inevitably, the pace of this world has gone up exponentially. So there are now a number of options that we have. And as I say, then it's about on a case-by-case basis for us, understanding the relative worth of this and how it's going to help them get better, and making sure that our communication, language, and alignment around that is well-timed and is right for that athlete at that time and right for that coach at that time. So I guess at an individual level, that's how we've started to unpack on-court physical determinants at a very basic level. We've got a number of, I guess, for want of a better description, performance science, sports analyst, business analyst stuff sitting behind that in terms of we had a new head of analysis who came into role, Chris White from the EIS, and his role was to look at the analysis system and how at the time it was very customer focused. So it was all about tagging in a certain way for this player and this coach for their needs. Whereas what Chris has done over time is homogenized that. So everything that we tag obviously comes into a central space. We start to build intelligence about what it really takes to, you know, be physically successful on court. Behind that, I employed a guy called Chris McLeod, who you may know, who from the EIS again, head of S&C, you know, incredible in terms of his ability to be reductionist in terms of how he thinks about physical determinants, really good in the comms space, working closely with our coaches, hugely curious. And he took the kind of direction of working closely with our coaches to understand what are the key physical movements you want to see, what do you really want to see your players do? And then behind that, what might be the kind of pillars of developing those things? And behind that, what might be the kind of, I guess, KPIs or physical metrics that you would attach to that? So we've got those kind of streams of work running in parallel. And that gives you some of the picture. And then I think some of the challenges we have in the tennis world are that although we can now get an understanding of training in quite a lot of detail, your ability to wear wearables in matches is very limited. And we've had to kind of go to the ITF and request the use of certain pieces of equipment, which we've been successful in kind of lobbying, to start to look at what's the difference between training and match. And in terms of a kind of light bulb moment for our coaches, in terms of their willingness and desire to look at this stuff, it was definitely when we started to look at, well, if training is X, but match is X times 10, how are we really well physically preparing our players for what they're about to do? And that's been brilliantly led through Chris McLeod and some of our other S&C coaches, Ian Elwood and Connor and Charlie, to kind of start to influence and talk in that language with coaches. So that's, I guess, the how. And then behind that, at a technical level, we've been looking at solutions to get past the fact that we can only really look at our players. And obviously now with some of the changes in camera technology, we've been working with a company externally called YPlayO, and we've been building software solutions that if you take an end-on camera, you can start to pixelate the screen and start to understand the movement dynamics of your player on court. So how fast, how many accelerations, and make some inferences therein. So you can start to look more broadly than only at your player population. Mm-hmm. And I guess a bit of a long-winded answer, isn't it?
No, but
I guess if you look at those components, I guess it's at an individual level, understanding their physical requirements in training and in match, understanding their game style and the physical determinants that they need to get better at to really maximize their potential, looking at a kind of system level of analytically what's required to be successful technically, tactically, and physically through our analysts, and then looking at hopefully some novel solutions to help accelerate those things forward. But again, you can only move as fast as your coaches and players want to move at the right time for them. But that would be a kind of summary of our process.
So would that camera negate the use of wearables, of a catapult? Okay.
So I guess, yeah, the vision for me always initially was, you know, can we make systems like Hawkeye and Catapult, not redundant, but can we move past them? And I think my view on this, and I'm not a particular technologist, would be that the higher the resolution of camera, which is inevitably going to only get better and better and better, and the high availability of camera in terms of recording any training session and any match for us without the need for kind of dedicated sports science support, it may well mid to long term be the direction of travel. It's never going to give you all your answers. And I still think in terms of understanding internal load, for want of a better description, you know, some method of understanding heart rate dynamics for us is really important. But I guess if you talk to some of the people we're working with, they start to talk about in the future facial recognition being a possibility, understanding stress through facial recognition being a possibility. So you can start to hopefully gain an even more holistic view on what's happening to that player in that moment and what's the impact of that in terms of their performance. So I definitely think there's long-term merit in that as a solution. But I'm sure that people like Catapult and others will move at speed to kind of keep themselves hugely relevant.
Yes, I would guess so. Where, I'm just going to round up because I know you've got to shoot us after six. That's all good. Back to the book. When can people get hold of it, Dan? And where would be the best place they can get it?
I don't really know. I mean, I think hopefully it's going to be released before the end of the year.
Yeah.
It's published through Human Kinetics, so I'm sure it'll be available in all good bookstores. And as I know more, I'll drop you an email and you can hopefully spread that around. But at the minute, 100%. we're kind of waiting for a few last sort of T's and C's from a few people. But as I say, we're really hopeful to have it out by the end of the year.
So similar format as before?
Pretty similar. We're fortunate to get, you know, some I guess new blood, new ideas into this. We took the view that rather than making it a true second edition where you only change a kind of small proportion of your narrative, we should maybe go for broke and look at again some broader ideas and concepts which are relevant now. And hopefully we've hit the sweet spot of that. So yeah, people like Brett and Nick Winkleman and others are in it. So it'll be good.
Superb. And where can people keep in touch with what you've got going on social media wise? Is that a place where you reside?
Yeah, loosely. So I'm at Dan Lewenden on Twitter, available, and LinkedIn and the usual. So yeah, people can, if they choose to, get hold of me for sure.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for an hour of your time, Dan. Really appreciate it. And look forward to the book. I'm sure it'll have just as much as impact as the first one. And which one's been harder, by the way, the first or the second, given the world in 2020?
Second edition of the first book has been harder because more authors and people are inevitably busier than they've ever been. Plus, we're probably still a bit knackered from the first edition, so it's been a bit of a harder climb, you know. I say it now confidently. There's no way we're doing it again.
Yes.
Quote.
Done.
Done.
Yes. Right, mate.
Thank you, mate. This has been brilliant. Thank you so much.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure. It's great to chat. Great to chat. Thanks, mate. Speak soon.
All right. See you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Dan. Big thanks to Dan for giving up his time. Like I say, he's been on the hit list for a long, long time. So it was great to finally get him on and have such a good time in having a chat with him. So I hope you got plenty from this episode. Also, big thanks to Hawking Dynamics, iMeasureU, Black Box Fitness, Kitman Labs and Perch for sponsoring this episode today. So if you're in the market for a VBT solution, AMS, gym equipment, inertial sensors or a force plate, make sure you check these guys out because they will deliver the best quality equipment but also with a great service as well. So thank you very much for tuning into this episode and I will chat to you next week.